obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Charles, and I'm an alcoholic. What a nice welcome that was. I want to thank everybody. Everybody has been just absolutely amazing. I especially want to thank Shirley for inviting me to come participate. The Committee of 68, I cannot believe I was not treated this well when I was drinking. Oh my God, I actually ate dinner tonight. And I could have ice in my glass and that was okay. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome you to AA. If you're new, I want to thank my sponsor. My sponsor's here, Doug, and his lovely bride, Tony. And I want to mention my home group. My home group is a Monday night Seal Beach speakers meeting. Yay! A fellowship of men and women that normally would not mix. And I love that. I love that about AA. And I have to tell you that I was the secretary there in 2002, 2003. I know you remember that. And we had our secretary's meeting. Our secretary's meeting was on Monday. And there are people. Cheryl C. is here and her husband, Jim. And then our beloved Debbie is here who comes from this area, who was also secretary there at that meeting. And she's Carol L. Now she's become R. She flew out from Oklahoma, and she actually, I think, came here to the convention, but then she showed up there for Secretary's Night, and it was such an honor. It was such an honor to be connected to those people. That meeting started in 1984, and every year after that, that meeting has continued on, and every year there has been a secretary, and I got to be one of those secretaries, and I did nothing but complain about that job that whole year long. I hated it. I hated it. But I can tell you that it's just such an incredible gift of being of service. And again, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come participate in your meeting. I want to mention that I have a sobriety date. I got sober after a particularly intense Cinco de Mayo party, which started on April the 26th. And I'd taken a drinking tequila because I thought you couldn't smell it on me. You know, it was clear, although I never drank the clear tequila. I always drank the, you know, Jose Cuervo with a worm in the bottle. Oh, look, a valid protein source somewhere in this bottle, you know. And that party started on April the 26th. On April 28th, I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the last time, and that was in 1987. Yeah, it's a long time. April 28th, I celebrated 28 years worth of continuous sobriety, which is the longest I have gone. And if you're new here, you're probably thinking, well, why would anybody want to do that? And I can tell you that it's turned out to be worth it. It's turned out to be worth it. I have done the things that have been required and asked of me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous so that I could maintain my sobriety. And, you know, I've gone to the meetings. I've had the commitments. I sponsor the people. That's one of the greatest gifts is, sponsorship. And I have stayed sober. And it is a preferred state for me today. And I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for the higher power that I found here and for the people who I am connected to in my life. If you're new here, I want you to know in doing those things, I have had the very best that life has to offer. I have had the finest teachers. I have had the richest feelings. I have had the most beautiful relationships. The best sex, not always in that order. TMI. No, that's okay. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it talks in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're trying to be like today. And I want you to know that this is the miracle. On April the 27th of 1987, I could not drink. I could not go more than 4 hours. I could not go. I would come to in the middle of the night, and I would drink, and I would pass out, and I would come to, and I would drink, and I was drinking around the clock, and on April the 28th, I woke up, and I was sober. On one day, I can't not drink, and on the next day, I was sober. And the thing that I did that was different between the 27th and the 28th was that I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a little clubhouse near my where I used to live called the Round Table. It was on 4th Street in Long Beach, the Round Table. Yay, there's some alumni from the Round Table. And it was 4 blocks away from where I lived, and I remember, you know, which I at that time I thought was North Long Beach, and it's not really. And I got up to that club, and you know, I walked, of course, because my car didn't, well, mostly didn't work, but so I walked, and I got there, and I arrived at that meeting 10 minutes early. I didn't time it right, and I arrived there 10 minutes early, and I sat in my little seat, and I was absolutely terrified. I was terrified because the secretary of the meeting was passing around the things, and I was absolutely, absolutely terrified that he was going to ask me to read. And of course he didn't, so I got mad. I hate AA. And I stayed sober, and I started to stay sober from that day to this, and I'm just so grateful, and I'm so grateful. You know, really what I want to do is I'm going to tell you about my codependent relationship with my dog. Okay? 2 years ago, the day before my birthday, all right, April the 27th, before my AA birthday, one of my sponsees had called me up. And I know you've had this conversation. Oh, Charles, you know, I was wondering if we might get together for coffee. And I said, well, yeah, sure. And so, he led with, you'll never guess what happened. And I thought, oh, it's going to be a long one. You know, and so we made arrangements the next day, which it was the day before my birthday, to go and meet at Whole Foods out in front of, it was right next door to this Petco. And so we were in there, we were talking. As it turned out, he'd inadvertently embezzled some money from a couple of his clients. And yeah. I share this with you because I think you can tell a lot about a person by who they attract. And and so, you know, he was telling me the story, and, you know, I'm a good sponsor. I thought, oh, you know, it could happen to anyone. You needed the money, you know. And then I wanted to know, so, like, how much are you in for, you know, ha, ha, ha. And then he told me, and I went, oh. Now, if you're new here and your sponsor goes, oh, it's not good. I kept thinking, oh my God, that's going to be a lot of reverse shoplifting, you know? He may never pay that back. You know? $5 a month. Oh my God. So I said, you know, the thing that we say as sponsors, well, we'll say a prayer about it, it'll all work out, you know. Which means I really don't know what you should do. And so what happened was, so you said, okay, bye, I'll see you later, I'll talk to you later, good luck, you know, go with God. And and as I was walking out across the parking lot, I looked over and I heard this yap and a bark, and there was this little dog like this, and you know, I have never in my life ever really thought seriously about owning a dog. I've never wanted a dog. I never thought about getting a dog. We bought a house. People asked us, are you going to get a dog? Why would we get a dog? I don't know, but I had to have it, you know? So the next day was my AA birthday. I picked up this dog. You know, there's a little dog and a box of food and a little dish in the front. And, you know, I took her to dog school. She flunked 4 times. I remember... I told the lady, you know, who was the trainer, she was AKC, and I said, well, you know, she's just not a good test taker. You know, well, the day before the last day of the first session, they said, well, tomorrow, the next week's going to be the final exam. I'm like, final exam? This is a dog. What do you mean final exam? Well, she didn't make it. 4 times, she, you know, anyway, but... So I love this dog, and what happened was our little routine on Monday nights is that I pick up the dog, I go home, get home from work, I, you know, relax a little bit, take a nap, pick up the dog, we go to the Seal Beach meeting, we stand there and save our seats for the meeting, then we come back, and at the end of our, you know, saving the seats, I take her for a little spin around the block and feed her, and then I go to the meeting, and this one, it was January 5th of this year, and it was a very exciting day because our friend Sarah Ann was going to be celebrating her 13th year of service. sobriety, and we were going to go out to dinner. And I got the dog, and we went in the car, and we saved the seats, and we went back, and we went to go take a little spin around the block. And what happened was, it was dark by 5:30, it was dark. And we'd gone around the block, and all of a sudden I heard this weird kind of patter, 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 and Lucy, the Border Terrier, came bolting toward us in the dark. And she you know, I saw this, you know, the gnashing white teeth, the mouth open, and she bit into my dog. And I pulled on the leash, and both dogs came up off the ground, and I couldn't believe it. And she was bleeding, and I was like, oh no. And we took her to the hospital, and they said, oh, it's serious, you have to take her to Irvine. And so we went down to the animal hospital in Irvine, and we walked in the door, and they whisked her off, and they said, you know, it's pretty serious. And the dog had punctured her abdominal wall, and her intestines were starting to, it was awful. And she was in the hospital for 5 days, and every day I called in the morning, how is she doing? And, you know, she's okay. She developed pancreatitis. It looks serious. And the fifth day was a Friday. I went down there by myself, and I said, I'm here to see my dog, Mia. And they said, okay, and they brought her to me, and she had a tube in her nose and one of those cones. And they said, she can't eat. She's not eating. We can't let her go until she eats. And I sat there, and I could not I couldn't believe it. It was like surreal. And I was like, there's so many things. I mean, that dog, every time I come home from work, that dog meets me at the door and runs around in little circles, and she follows me around the house. And she jumps up on the couch, and she always has her paw on my leg. She always has to touch me at some, you know. And I just couldn't, I couldn't believe it. And they said, you know, it's serious. And she has to eat. And she wasn't eating. And the guy, the tech, came. And he said, well, I have to take her now. It was Friday night. And I grabbed her cone, and I looked at her, and the tube was looking at me. And I said, you have to eat. I love you. You have to eat, or they're not going to let you come home. And then I asked the tech the question I had. And that was, if she doesn't make it, do we still have to pay? You know, just keeping it real. That's, I mean, really. But the thing is, as I was driving home that night, who is this person? Who is this person in this body? This is not me. This is not the person that crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I, you know, all my life, it felt to me like I was surrounded by enemies, and one false move and it was all going to be over, you know. And I the feelings that I had about myself, the restlessness, the irritability, the discontent. Everybody was an enemy, and I remember just crawling through the doors of AA, all hunched over with bitterness and resentment, and just full of hate, absolutely full of hate. And if I was drinking, you got me in a better condition than if I was sober. And if I was sober, you didn't talk to me for 3 minutes before I started bitching about my life and how I hated my life, and I hated those customers at work, and I hated that relationship. And I just was so full of bitterness and resentment. And I had resentment that was so deep I couldn't even feel it. And I remember coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the first meetings I went to was a Tuesday night Naples speakers group, and there was this woman there. Her name was Birthday Betty, and she, made a birthday cake every year. And I remember the first, or every week for the people who were celebrating their birthdays. And I remember the first time that I saw her, I thought, oh my God, this is the most pathetic thing I've ever seen in my life. And I grew to love the, you know, these people, and but it just seemed to me that those people, people like Betty, people like Dottie Harris, they would come up and they would put their arms around me and they say, "We love you and we want you to keep coming back." And this to me was like a knife through the heart. And this is what it was. Who am I? Who is this? And that this is a miracle, and this is what is something that has been created through the through a loving higher power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember getting home and just saying, you know, what do we do? What do we do? Sometimes they tell us, don't have any expectations. Don't have any. Page 449, no expectations. And I know we're not supposed to have expectations. I know that. And I also know that sometimes we do. And sometimes you think you're going to get that job and you don't. Or sometimes you think that that relationship's going to work out and it doesn't. And as it turns out, always the IRS really wants their money. You know? But we suit up and show up and turn our will and our lives over to the care of God and say, "Thy will be done." And I remember going to bed that night. It was Friday night. And Saturday morning, I got a phone call. And it was from the vet. And they said, "She ate last night, and you're going to be able to come and pick her up." And I was so happy that she was okay. Anyway, now you can see what I'm like today. So I should probably tell you what I used to be like. I, you know, want you to know that I had my first drink. I was 14 and a half years old. I don't know why this. I don't know why my parents did this, but my parents decided at some point that I should go off to Geneva, Switzerland, to boarding school to learn how to speak French. And I have no idea, still to this day, why they did that. But I remember. But this is what I remember. I remember the night before that we left. Now, here's me on the cover of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Restless, irritable, discontent. I have no friends. I don't like you. I don't want to talk with you. I don't want to play with you. I'm in, you know, junior high school. And then what happened, you know, my big dream in seventh grade was to be the national champion marimba player, you know? I was obsessed with, you know, I'm going to be great. And, you know, and I got pretty good. I could do Girl from Ipanema with three mallets, you know? Maybe. But here it was the night before I was, you know, it was the night that I was to go off. And, you know, and I knew really what my problem was that I was a geek. That's what my problem was. I'm a geek. That's my problem. And you know, I was pretty bad. I had a pocket protector. I was in the marching band, you know. I liked Barry Manilow. You know. And I knew that something had gone terribly wrong with me. And for me, this was particularly horrible because I had this sister. She's one of those varsity cheerleading types with a trick pelvis. She said, "Give me a V," and her legs would go up in the air. You know, and she was real popular, you know. Oh, you know her. And I wasn't. I was just this big geek, and I just hated myself. I hated myself. And, you know, they say men and women drink because of the effect produced by alcohol. And I made a decision based on those feelings of self-hatred that I must change. And I wanted to be a cool person. I wanted to be a cool person. And, you know, I didn't really know what what makes a person a cool person. And I can tell you today, after 28 years of being sober, I can tell you what makes a cool person cool. That they're kind, considerate, warm, friendly, genuine, sincere, or that they at least have money. You know? But I didn't know back then. What I thought made a cool person was that they drank and they partied. And so I made a decision based on those feelings to drink. And I had my first drink, and I was traveling through Switzerland, and I ordered, my first drink was a liter of Gamay Beaujolais 78, which I ordered because I could pronounce it, right? And I was a wino from the beginning. And not only was I a wino, but I was a pretentious wino. I found out you could get this Gamay Beaujolais here in the United States. We call it Gallo Hardy Burgundy for $1.99 in the box. You know, a convenient thing you put on the countertop, and every time you walk by with the tumbler, you just hit off it, and it's almost like you've only had one all day long, you know. So So I had this drink, and I have to tell you, and I know that this is sacrilegious. I have heard this several times from people at podiums similar to this. This is sacrilegious. There was really very little bit of that, very little about that first drink that I liked. I didn't like, I didn't like feeling gagging when I took the first hit off of it, when it went down. I didn't like the taste of it. I didn't like getting dehydrated. I didn't like getting the spins. But I'm an alcoholic, and that alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for other people, and that when I took that first drink, I felt okay. I felt like I cared about you. I felt like I wanted to know about you. I felt like I could talk to you. I could look you in the eye. And that was the feeling. You know, tonight we were at dinner and we were laughing about, Cliff Roach talks about the 8 minutes. Oh, 8 minutes. And alcohol worked. And you know what? I don't know if I was born, you've heard this 100,000 times. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I took my first drink and an alcoholic was born. And immediately, I was a daily drinker. I came back to the United States. By this time, I'm in high school. My mom's dropping me off at school. I'm saying, she's telling me, have a nice day. I'm all kiss, you too. And then I, cut class and slip around the back of the gym and smoke cigarettes and drink. And all my heroes changed. My role models changed. They went from, Aristotle, Euclid, Shakespeare, Wally and the Beeve, to people who were, petty criminals and all this stuff, And I said, this is going to be a whole new me. I'm cool now. And I parted my hair down the middle and got it feathered back and bought some puka shells. And and it was on, and I loved it. And I remember at one point, we ripped off the baritone saxophone from the band room and took it to the pawn shop so we could buy drugs. And I just, this is it. This was the life. And it was great. I got all my classes, which became actually very upsetting for my mother, who was a PTA president, because I might not graduate. This was a little bit stressful for her. But what happened was, at the end of my junior year, I said to myself something that I was to say for even a long time coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was this. This has been great fun. This has been amazing. This has been an incredible experience. But now I'm going to put all this stuff away, and I'm going to get it together. And now's my chance. I'm going to get it together. And I went at that time for the longest time that I had been, except for with the exception of my last sobriety date, and that was 9 months. It was my senior year in high school. At the end, nothing for 9 months, nothing. I went for nothing. And I had always thought when I was drinking that my problem was alcohol and that my problem was drinking. And what I discovered now looking back is that my problem isn't drinking at all. My problem as an alcoholic is not drinking. And at the end of that 9 months, I freaked out. I had this, breakdown. I was threatening to kill my mom. She'd grabbed the desk chair and was doing kind of this lion tamer things. And, I'm going to call the cops. It's for your own good. And it was as a result of that incident, my parents invited me to leave, and they suggested I might like to live somewhere else. And so what happened was I packed up my little Volkswagen, Rabbit with all my worldly possessions. I remember my sister came by with a little baggie of weed as a parting gift, and I moved to Long Beach. I spent my first night in Long Beach on the corner of Roy Crofton Division in my car, and I was, hitting off that weed and thinking about how, now that those people were out of my life was going to be great. Everything was going to be great. And I sat in that car and I listened to 94.7 KMET, and eventually I, classic rock. Eventually I, passed out in the car and didn't turn off the radio, so the next morning when I came to and tried to start the car, the battery was dead, and it was kind of like it didn't get much better. You know what I mean? I knew one thing. I was going to go to Long Beach State, and I had dreams. I wanted to go to Long Beach State. I wanted to get it, and one of the things I wanted to do was become a school teacher and buy a house and make something of myself. And
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And what happened? What happened was I got a job. I signed up for classes at Long Beach State. About a month into my first semester at Long Beach State, I had 12 units. I dropped all of my classes except for swimming. And, the alcoholic, you set a goal, don't reach the goal, so you set the bar higher. So the next semester, I signed up for 15 units, and I dropped all of them except for volleyball. And then the next semester, I signed up for 18 units, and then I just didn't ever show up again. You know what I mean? And there was about three semesters after that I would register and pay for classes, but then I just never went. And what happened was I got a job instead. I got a job. I lived at the beach in Long Beach, and there was a restaurant in Belmont Shore called the Northwoods Inn. It was this big log cabin with snow on the roof, which is, when you think about it, it's the most bizarre thing at the beach. And of course, I had to work there. And I went in to my boss. I said, hi, the guy who was to become my boss. I said, my name's Charles. I'm 18 years old. I'd like to be a waiter. He said, well, you have to be 21 to be a waiter, but you can be a host. I said, okay. So I started being a host. And my next birthday, I turned 21. And I told him, I'm 21 now. He said, okay, you can be a waiter. And in the beginning, it wasn't enough money. It just wasn't enough money. And so I got another job. I got another job in this little bar. And so I worked the lunch shift at the Northwoods Inn, and then I worked in this bar at night. And what happened at the lunch shift, what I really loved about the Northwoods Inn was that for 25 cents, you could buy a schooner of Blitz Bavarian dark beer after your shift. And that started out to be enough, this big thing. And then I'd have a couple, and then I'd have three, and then I'd have four, and that would get me going. And my shift at the bar started at 9 o'clock. All the guys would meet in the well at 9 o'clock, and we'd do the 9 o'clock shot. And then we did the 10 o'clock shot. And then we did the 10:30 shot. And then we did the 10:37 shot, and all bets were off, you know what I mean? And I loved it. And some nights I got to be the bar back, which meant that I could change the wine keg. They had a keg of wine. Could you imagine? This huge, oh, I loved it. And then what happened was there was this hose that hooked it up to the tap. You had to on the hose. Oh, I love, oh, a little glass of wine. And then and then what happened was, so I was working at the restaurant during the day. I was working at the bar at night. And I was drinking all the time. And there was a point up until then where I thought that I might have had some kind of control. And after, then there came a point where if it was a good idea to drink, it soon became a necessity. And I was drinking every day, and I could not stop. And I'm described in the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde passage in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where he goes to bed so intoxicated he should sleep the clock round. But there he is early next morning, all lit up again. And that was me. I would pass out, it would be 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd come to at 6:02. And I'd see those red letters flash, and I'd be so dehydrated and so thirsty. And I'd say, I gotta stop tomorrow. And then I started making the tomorrow promise. Tomorrow's gonna be the day. Tomorrow I'm gonna stop. I'm gonna stop drinking tomorrow. And always what happened was that tomorrow eventually became today. And I remember that there was one day I got up and I said, this is going to be the day. And I got dressed. I took a shower. I got dressed. I went to the bank or something. And on the way home, I stopped by the liquor store and I bought this like half gallon of Jack Daniels for a special occasion. And I... which turned out to be later on that afternoon. And, I remember that I lived alone in this apartment and I had it up in this cupboard because I didn't want anyone to know I had it up there. I lived alone. And I remember, I thought, I got so much done. I'm just going to have a little celebration. So I went to go reach up for this thing. And I don't know if you know, but the jumbo Jack Daniels is this big square bottle. And my hands didn't quite fit around. And I remember starting to pull it out. And it was like the worst nightmare you could even imagine. I mean, it fell out of the cupboard and went whoo, 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 exploded on the edge of the counter, and it was all on the kitchen floor, shards of glass and a big puddle of Jack Daniels. And I remember when I first got sober telling my sponsor at that time, Chuck W., I said, you know, I was so ashamed because when that happened, my first impulse was to get on my hands and knees and to lick it up. And he said, you should have got a sponge. Oh, I didn't. So take what you can use. No, anyway. And I said, you know, and my life fell apart, and anything that I had wanted to do, it all went by the wayside. And I said the first of several naked prayers, and that was, God, I don't know what's wrong with me, and I don't know what to do. And I got this idea to call Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did. And I, you know, I have no idea how I got that telephone number, but I got the number, and I called, and some redneck answered the phone, you know, and said, you know, I told him the truth. I'm having a problem with my drinking. And he said, well, we can come by and take you to a meeting. And I said, well, actually, that's okay. I can get them to the meeting on my own. And I didn't go to a meeting. And I didn't go to a meeting, but what I did do is I continued to drink. And I continued to drink, and I got in my car, and I drove, and I got arrested, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous anyway. And as part of that process, I had to get a little court card, and I always knew which one was mine because it had a big wine stain on it. And they told me you got to go to a lot of meetings. You go to one every other week for 3 months. That was the 502 school, and I started to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my first meeting. It was in November of 1984, and it was at this club, not a club, it was at the Rec Center in Cherry Park on Long Beach on Thursday night at 8:30. And I remember pulling up to that meeting in my car, actually parked several blocks away because I didn't want anybody to see my car. And I mean, I walked to the meeting, and what happened, it was, out in front, there were all these people, and they were smoking and drinking coffee, and it was just kind of like when we walked in through here, but without the cigarettes, and which is always still very sad to me. I used to be able to smoke in meetings. It was divine, really. I love that, the incense of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway. But I digress. And so I, you know, and I went to, they said, get the secretary and have him sign your card. And so I said, hey, where's the secretary? He says, that blonde guy over there. So I went to the blonde guy. I said, can you sign my card? I'll sign your card after the meeting. And I thought, God, they don't even know me and they don't like me, you know. And I sat down and I had the first spirit of what I have now consider a spiritual experience. I recognize it today. And it wasn't anything like, I mean, when I think about the profundity, the depth of this experience, and then I think about what it looked like, it didn't look like anything. What it looked like was I sat in a meeting and I listened to one alcoholic share their experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic, and I felt better. That was it. But that was so much. And I got in my car and I drove back home and I, you know, continued to drink. And I remember my 502 school, they said, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you have a progressive disease, it's terminal, it's just like cancer, eventually you'll die from it. You got to stop. You can't drink anymore. And I thought, well, that's okay. I'd rather smoke pot anyway. So on February the 2nd of 1985, I had my last drink at that time. And on February the 14th, Valentine's Day, I started a little, you know, marijuana maintenance. That chapter 2 thing about controlling and enjoying, or we're going to somehow beat the game. And I went to work, and I still had that job at the restaurant. And I went to the restaurant, and I looked at the schedule, and I thought, oh, my God, everybody who works here is an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic. There's one Al-Anon that kept the doors open for business, Mr. Bruno, Danny Bruno. And I, you know. The rest are all alcoholics. I tell people, you know what your problem is that you're an alcoholic and you should go to AA, you know, and occasionally every day I sat in my apartment and I'd, you know, get high, and somehow I ended up with this little stray cat, and I never liked smoking pot alone, and so I thought, well, I read in Hemp Magazine, if you blew the marijuana smoke into the face of your beloved domestic animal, they would get high too. And I thought, well, it's like, one for me, one for you. You know, and after a while, he was like all leaned over like this with bloodshot eyes. And there's me, you're high, you're high. We'd sit on the couch, we'd listen to Todd Rundgren, you know, can we
we still be friends? You know, love is the answer. Oh, I love that. And then the horrible thing happened was that the county went dry. Oh, my God. And we both freaked out a little bit. But the cats are running around the apartment and tearing up all the furniture. And I was like, oh, no, I had to get rid of it. I was like, oh, this it was so tragic. It was totally tragic. I was like, oh, you got to go now. You're my only friend, you know. Goodbye. Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. And all the time I'm telling, I just love that AA, you know, it's keeping me, this sobriety is great, I love it. And I got to tell you, if you've got a red hot program like that, eventually you're going to drink again. And I remember I was working at the restaurant and there was this girl, the cashier, her name was Heidi. Her mother was this AA diva from the South Bay. And one day she was going to come and she was going to have dinner or she's going to have lunch on my station. And my mom's coming in. The woman came in and sat down and she said, oh, Charles, are you a friend of Bill W? And I'm like, oh, yeah, we used to work together at the Silver Fox. How's he doing? She's like, what? And then she asked me, well, when's your birthday? And I said, well, it's October 9th. And she said, that's in a couple of days. How many years? I'm like, 23. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I work an individual program. I have an individual program. You know, it says these are just suggestions. And what happened? What happened? What do you think happened? I drank again, and they said, and this was the thing, they said, if you drink again, you're going to pick up right where you left off. And I drank, and I got in my car, and I drove, and I was coming down that 605 freeway. It was 9 or 10 o'clock at night. I saw the red flashing lights behind me, and I pulled over, and the officer said, excuse me, sir, but you were weaving. And I'm like, weaving? No, I was just a-wiving. And they didn't think that was funny, you know, threw my ass in jail. Well, here I am. And eventually I ended up back here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I surrendered. And one of the things, I got to tell you this, if you're a person who's had to go out and come back again and go out and come back again, or that's my story. And it turned out for me to be the greatest gift because I have learned. I knew when I came back all the things I hadn't done. I knew all the things. And you know what? I'm the kind of guy that if you tell me to do something, I want you to be able to explain it to me. It needs to make sense. If you're going to tell me to do something, it has to make sense. It really needs to make sense. And most of what I heard here didn't really make sense. I mean, you know, but there are a couple of things that you didn't have to explain to me. You didn't have to explain to me white knuckle sobriety. You didn't have to explain to me white knuckle sobriety. You didn't have to explain to me about the committee in my head that talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and everybody had an opinion and then we took a vote and then it went the one way anyway, you know? You didn't have to explain to me that one drink was too many and 1,000 never enough. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered and I started doing the things that we do here. Eventually I got a sponsor. My sponsor got me working on the steps and I started doing what we do. Well, you know, I was 3 months sober. I took a third step. 4 months sober, I wrote my inventory. 5 months sober, I did my fifth step. And we made a list in my sixth step and said some prayers in my seventh step. And then we made another list. And those were the people that I needed to make amends to. And then in the ninth step, he told me, you need to go and make amends to these people. And I remember one of the people that was in that was my stepfather. And I absolutely hated my stepfather. And when I crawled through the doors of AA, one of the resentments that I did not feel was the resentment I had for my stepfather. And I was 6 years sober, and my sponsor told me, you got to deal with that. You got to deal with him. You got to make amends to him. And I thought, ugh. And what had happened was when I was three, my father had been in a car accident. And he was rushed to the hospital and then he died. And my mom married a guy. And I looked at my mom and she was grieving and she was young and she, you know, had these two kids and she was 22 years old. And at that time, women didn't work and she didn't have an education. What was she going to do? And she married a guy. And I hated her. and by extension hated him. And it talks about in the 10th step, in the 12 and 12, it talks about, you know, we truly love but a few, hated the many and were indifferent to the rest so long as they didn't give us any trouble. And I can tell you that we lived, our house where we lived in Glendora was around the corner from the elementary school where I used to go to school. And every day, my sister and I would leave the house to walk to school, and I always say goodbye to my mother, and I never say goodbye to my dad. I never say goodbye. And I was watching, of course, Oprah Winfrey, and there was some psychologist had written this, you know, book on how to have a, you know, the step family and what to do and what not to do. And I went down that little checklist that they projected up on the screen. And they didn't do that. 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 And my sponsor said, "You have to make amends." And I, "What do you want me to do? What do I need to do?" And he said, "I want you to write him a letter." And I said, "Okay, I'll write him a letter." And it would have been weird for me to show up and just, because a lot of people after the meeting want to share with me, "Well, that's not how you're supposed to do a Manson." Well, okay. So what I did was I wrote this letter. And I wrote that letter and I thanked him. And I thanked him for and how much courage he must have had to marry a woman that had two little kids that he didn't ever have kids before. And I thanked him for providing us with enough food and clothes and a roof over our head and a swimming pool. And I thanked him for taking me back to the DMV when I flunked my driver's test twice. And I told him, I thanked him, I said, "You know, every time I think of my real father, I always think of you. And I love you." And when that happened, all of my relationships with men outside changed. Everything changed. Up until that time, I was still dropping out of school. I couldn't finish a class. I couldn't manage my finances. I was thousands and thousands of dollars in debt. And I had no idea that all of this was connected to that. And my life started to change. And I started to move forward. And I remember my sponsor asking me, "Well, what do you want to do with yourself? What do you want to do with yourself? You got to do something with your sobriety." And I said, "I want to become a school teacher." He said, "Well, you need to go back to school." And so I said, "Okay." And I started going back to school. And I have to tell you, from the first day that I set foot at Long Beach State to the day that I switched the tassel over on my thing at Cal State Dominguez Hills, it was 18 years. It took me 18 years to graduate from school, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it eventually happened. And I had completed the requirements for me to be able to become a school teacher, and I had a job through the Long Beach Unified School District. And I remember the Sunday before I was to start my job, I was going to be teaching middle school, and I was going to be teaching reading. And what happened was that the Sunday night before I started my job, all my AA friends came over to my house, and they helped me make decorations for my classroom. And school started on Wednesday, and I remember showing up, and I was ready, and I was clean, and my pants were pressed, and my shirt was pressed, and I was ready, and the kids were all lined up at the door, and I let them in, and they said, "Hi, Mr. Norman," and I thought, oh, I looked around, because I thought it was my dad they were talking about, and he said, "Oh, no, they're talking to me." And I worked really, really hard that first year. I worked really hard, and I had heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that your wildest dreams will come true, that your heart's desire will manifest. I suited up, and I showed up every day. And at the end of that school year, I cannot tell you just how much I hated that fucking job. I hated it. I was ready to... I'm standing at the door of my classroom, "Get out of here, you bastard children." You know, God, I hated it. Oh, my God. Mrs. Kupfer, the big angel of school, she threatened to write me up for chewing Nicorette gum. "You know, Mr. Norman, this is a gum-free zone, you know."
Oh, I hate it. And I remember my sponsor telling me, actually, you know who it was, Lisa? It was your dad, Bob Decker. My sponsor at that time was Bob Decker. He said, Charles, you got to suit up and show up one day at a time. He told me, you can leave if you have to, but suit up and show up one day at a time till the end of the school year, because I needed the benefits to have gum surgery because of all the drugs I took during the 80s. You know? Oh, God. Oh, and I did, and I thought, how can this be? How can this be? You know, this was my dream. How can I, you know? Oh, it was horrible. And so I started. I said, this is like an AA commitment. I'm going to do, and I worked really, really, really hard. And then all of a sudden, I got this phone call from the principal, and I thought, oh, what is it now? What have I done now? And I was teaching English at the time to people who, well, actually I was teaching reading to people, seventh graders who don't want to read. Oh, that's fun. Anyway, so I remember going to into the principal. She said, Mr. Norman, have a seat. And I sat down and I was getting ready to sign the paper, you know, because we always end up signing some paper. And she said, I need you to teach French. And I thought, oh my God. They need me to teach French, and I started teaching French, and I have to tell you, I didn't know anything about teaching French. I didn't know. I just made shit up. I'd make stuff up and then give them a quiz. I thought, you know, they're never going to know. They're never going to know. They're going to forget, and they're not going to know. Oh, my God. Oh, and you know, I would just, oh, and I remember the kids would ask me, because we talk a lot about Paris, and they're like, hey, Mr. Norman, have you ever been there? And I tell them, no, but one day I'm gonna. And in 2005, when I turned 18 years sober, I went to Paris, and I went to the top of the Eiffel Tower. And when I came back to school, I could tell them, I have been to the top of the Eiffel Tower, and you hold on to the bars, you can feel the cold wind going through the bars, and you can look down, and the first thing that you want to do is you want to jump. And they're like, why does he want us to go there, you know? Oh my God. And I have to tell you this, I have to tell this one story. It was like my second year teaching French, and there was this little girl I had, her name was Justine Armstrong, and at Christmas she gave me this little nutcracker, and it was like a little thing to hang on the tree, and I said, oh, and I, you know, I don't know what to do. I stuck it up on the shelf and forgot about it, but by the end of that season there were three of them up there on that shelf, and I thought, oh, and I put them in a box and stuck them in a cupboard, and the next Christmas I found this box. I said, oh, I should put these out. And then what happened was that all of a sudden my students started buying me these nutcrackers. And you know what? I didn't know this about 11-year-olds. When an 11-year-old gives you a present, they want you to open it up right there, and they want you to tell them all the things that you love about it. And I remember pulling this. Oh, this is my favorite one. And I have to tell you that another thing that they like about that is they love it when you send them a thank you card home. And there was this girl that she gave me a little nutcracker, and I wrote down her name and address, and I sent her this Christmas card home. You know, thank you so much for the wonderful gift. She was in sixth grade at that time, and in eighth grade, she pulled out her backpack, and she's graduating middle school. She opened up her backpack, and she pulled out that card, and she had that card there with a little picture of me and her that somebody had taken. And she said, you know what, you're always my favorite teacher. And I thought, you know, that's the gift to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to have these kind of feelings and to make a difference in the world. And if you're new here, you really probably don't give a rat's ass, and that's okay. But I want you to know that we want you here with us. We want you with us. We want you with us. And I remember, you know, my sponsor used to make me write these stupid gratitude lists. I'm like, why am I writing a gratitude list? You know, I need you to explain to me, how is this going to get me a job in a relationship? You know what I mean? I write these gratitude lists. And eventually the day came when I felt actual real gratitude. Gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that I love here and the feelings that I'm able to have. Thanks for having me. I better get my water.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. We'll be right back.